Hello and welcome to the Walt Weekly Podcast with your host, Walter Latham Sr. and co-host, Michelle Sweeney McCombs.
All right, the Walt Weekly Podcast has gotten sourcing requests, a request from a private group. And they are looking for a Black American leader. So they contacted us to conduct some interviews and, you know, do the recruiting thing. And we do have a candidate that we have that we will be interviewing today. There are more to come, but we tried to whittle down the number of candidates based on the requirements. And we're going to get started. So we have Mr. Joe Williams who came in, and he's our second interview, and we will proceed. If Mr. Williams is ready, we will start this interview.
Most certainly. Thank you really for inviting me, Walt, and obviously I look forward to what you're trying to do and being a part of what you're trying to do and hopefully putting my best foot forward in trying to meet, obviously, the demands that you're asking.
Well, thank you. Thank you. May I call you Joe?
You most certainly can.
All right. Thank you. All right. Joe, you saw the requirements and I saw your resume. And let's start with one, which I think is one of the more important things on here, requirements is you are ADOS, Americans descendant of slaves, right? You're descendant of slaves?
That is, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Most certainly. As a matter of fact, my lineage goes all the way back to South Carolina and slaves and slavery. Being a part of that ancestry, as that's where my ancestors migrated from during slavery and after slavery. They came up from South Carolina to Chicago, Louisiana, and also Philadelphia.
Okay. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. What do you think, though, that we would want for the position of Black American leader? And that's a leader of Black Americans. You know, you heard of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. You know, there's been a vacuum since the 60s and 70s where we don't have a leader. But what do you think that we would attempt to fill this position? And can it be filled?
Well, first, let me just say, you know, when you talk about the folks that have obviously come before and have been Black leaders, I must tell you, I had the opportunity when I was younger. I was about, I'm going to say, between 8, 9 years old of meeting Malcolm X. And it was very interesting because when we were younger, my brother and I used to, you know, play on the front lawn of our house in Mount Airy, Chestnut Hill, Philadelphia. And every year, these cars would pull up and park, you know, on the street in front of the house next door. And these gentlemen would always get out. And we were always very, I guess you could say, impressed by them because they were very stoic. They were very kind of like regimented, dressed very well. Fedoras, you know, bow ties and so on. And we didn't know who they were. We just thought, man, these cars are really beautiful. These guys are really impressive. And they would always go into this house and they would always escort this one man into that house. Well, when I got to be about it's somewhere between 8 and 10 years old, my father told me, you know, that he wanted to take me next door to meet someone. And again, these cars had pulled up. And these men got out, and this one man was the center of their attention. And when we got over to, you know, my next door neighbors, it was ironic because I recognized who this was, having seen a lot of the civil rights situations and this man on television. It was Malcolm X. And I got to sit down and talk with him for about 10, 15 minutes. And I was young, but I was quite impressed with him and everything he had to say. Now, what I didn't know was that the two brothers that lived in that house were his bodyguards when he came into Philadelphia to go to Mosque number 12, which was Jeremiah Shabazz's mosque in Philadelphia. And their mother was Malcolm X's administrative assistant when he came into Philadelphia. So it was quite impressive to me, and I'll never forget the conversation with him, but I say that only to relate to what a black leader should be about. And the thing that was most impressive to me about Malcolm and the conversation that he had with me was his commitment to his people, the commitment to the cause of his people, and his commitment to never sway from that or be basically in any way distracted by anything else, but to maintain that consistent focus. So if I have to say, you know, what it takes just right up front in terms of a black leader, it would have to be commitment. Commitment and understanding, appreciation, and a determination, a loyalty to make whatever needs to happen for the benefit of changing the trajectory and the course of our people in these United States.
How you doing?
Hey, Michelle, how are you?
Thank you for joining. Got a little tickle in my throat. I'm sorry.
All right. Yeah.
That story about Malcolm is true. That's not fictitious.
I believe
that
it.
All right.
No, I believe it.
I believed it too. This is Mr. Joe Williams that we're interviewing. All right. Okay. All right. Back to the interview. Okay. My second question is, Joe, where did you go to school?
Okay. I went to Temple University for 4 years, and I got a bachelor's degree in radio, television, and film, but also basically with a minor in political science. I also spent some time, did not get a degree, but did attend some courses when I lived in Europe at Oxford University in England. And again, the major course of study was largely history and also political science. But unfortunately, I did not get to finish due to, you know, some personal family circumstances that had to be dealt with. So that's the extent of that. Also, basically, seminary. I went to the seminary basically to be a or become a pastor, and did do so, becoming an ordained minister, and that was very beneficial to obviously again my ability to really have a very centered, very moral, and very, I guess you could say, righteous path in terms of just life in general.
Right. I see. So did you get a degree when you went to seminary?
No, at the seminary, I did not. I did not finish basically with a degree. And the reason I did not finish was because I really took exception to what was happening in the seminary. And there are a lot of other guys that were in the seminary at that time with me who experienced the same thing. There became a certain point in the seminary where they began to become more aimed at teaching, I guess you could say, the theory of the gospel, but they were not necessarily really teaching those who were seeking to be ministers the heart of the gospel. It became much more a head thing than it did a heart. And we all could not abide by that, because at that particular point, we just saw, you know, what was happening. They were putting out a lot of folks that had a real good head knowledge of the gospel, but no real heart for it. So they were more business than they were, I guess you could say, you know, actual purveyors of the heart of Christ. And we could not condone that, nor could we abide by that. And so we literally just left in the middle of the second semester.
Okay. Michelle, you have any questions for Mr. Williams?
Do you plan to pursue your degree? It's never too late.
No, not in the seminary. I did become a minister, and I am an ordained minister and have been for about what I'm going to say now, probably close to 25 years. I decided to just take the courses that I needed online through Anchor Bay and several other well-known establishments that this can be done. And I did get a degree in ministry, again, of which I am and have been for 25 years.
Awesome. So do you think that you can incorporate this with your leadership skills?
It is a definite incorporation. Given the nature of what we see today as it would pertain to politics, as it would pertain to the politics that is relative and associated with our people, Black people, the ability to be able to walk a very fine line and not to be distracted to the left or to the right, but really maintain a very moral and focused purpose, it is a necessity, in my opinion. Too many things, basically, you know, are obviously going on politically that can draw you this way or that way. There's too much money involved. There's too much status. Just many things that just really distract one from the focus and the purpose of what, obviously, you're trying to do and what you're hoping to accomplish in that.
Right. Right. So how would you be able to implement any of these actions that you just spoke about into being a great leader?
Well, the first thing is to be able to recognize, you know, that you are a leader and what that means. That's the first thing. One must, in my opinion, understand that to be a leader, they first and foremost must be right within themselves. And they must be basically very clear on who they are before they even attempt to tackle the aspect of being a leader. Second, the ability to really be very honest and very truthful about who and what you are as a leader and why you are actually doing this or your anticipation is to be a leader in that regard. So I think those are the two most important things that I would first and foremost say I would have to do. I would have to let, you know, myself know that I am who I am in this and that I need to maintain a course personally and spiritually of those right things and those moral things, because I have to reflect those to everyone I deal with. And secondly, I need to help the constituents, the people that I'm going to be dealing with and fighting for, understand what that means and why it's important to me, because it should be important to them in my being able to carry out whatever the functions are that I need to carry out for them, and to allow them to know that I am going to do that honestly, that I am going to do that sincerely, but most importantly, I am not going to take any shorts in any way that would be contrary to who I am and who they need me to be and want me to be.
Amen.
That sounds good.
I love that. So as a Black American leader, what qualifications would you expect of building a team under yourself?
You know, that is a good question. And I've had the experience of having teams. And I've got to be very honest with you in this regard. I've always looked at the fact that, you know, most of the time when teams are being put together, everyone says they want the smartest and the brightest and the most educated. Well, I tend to differ in that. I want those who are hungry. Hungry to do the work that has to be done and not be in a position where they think more highly of themselves than they actually are. So that would be the situation for me. And teams that I've put together, I have looked at that first and foremost. I don't care what your education is. That's good. That's great. And it has a bearing. But what I am more concerned with is, are you able to put that education on the side and really, really fulfill obligation with the heart, the passion, and the conviction that is necessary?
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you for that. Walter?
Yeah, Joe. When you mentioned passion, would that also, would you look for that in your team? You know, you have to, you know, exude passion. I think that's the way that you get people to believe in you. You know, how would you get a go about, because you would start this from the ground up. How would you go about getting people to follow you? That's one of the hardest things to do.
Well, I've always had an understanding of this, you know, obviously dealing with the human condition. And the fact of the matter is, I've always looked at it in the context that I don't want them to follow me. Because human nature is very, very suspect when it begins to put itself in a position of looking at one person and assuming that they are the total authority. They can get lost in that and forget the purpose. And the person whom they look to can also get lost in that and forget the objective. So I don't want people to follow me. I want people involved in the cause who will follow the dictates of the cause. Not me, because you see, too many times, people basically will follow people, but forgetting that this is a human being like any other human being. And if a mistake is made by that human being, which it could be and can happen, people will then arbitrarily lose their conviction. They will lose their passion and they will lose their fervor for it because it was wrapped up in that individual, not in the cause. I would prefer basically to enlist people who will look at it in that context. It is about the cause. I am just basically a cog in that wheel. I bring everyone together. I establish in any way I can, mutually and concisely with them, the projection, the place that we're going, what we're attempting to accomplish. But I never want it to be a situation where everyone is looking at me as the overall leader and the sum and total of it, because I'm not the sum and total of it. If I were, then I would not need the team. If I was the sum and total of a thing, I wouldn't need them. So I want everyone to understand that they are all part of this. They are all basically the head of this. They are all the leaders in this, because that's important. It distinguishes everything from the aspect of one person becoming the sum and total of a thing.
I like that response.
That's great.
Yeah, thank you. I really like that. How are you with geopolitics? You know, from a global perspective, anything that happens globally impacts us. And what's your worldview on that, or your point of view?
Well, the point of view is the fact that, look, the world is the world. The world was basically the way it is before I came into the picture, before you came into the picture. And at the rate things are going, the world is going to be the same way when we go out of the picture. I mean, the geopolitical situation is always progressing, but in my opinion, it is never progressing in a method or means or way that it will solve the problems of the world. If anything, it literally is progressing in creating more problems. So when I look at the geopolitical situation, I look at it in that context. We are not going to solve situations because, you know, you were talking geopolitics, and everybody in the world, wherever they may be, has a different viewpoint, a different perspective, and a different objective. But yet that does not cure, and it has not cured up to this point, poverty throughout the world, famine, racism. All of these things still exist, but yet we have a geopolitical thrust that is supposed to be about the business of dealing with this, the United Nations, the G, I think it is what, 20 or 8 or whatever that is.
We got the G7 and we got the G20.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, all of these things are supposed to be looking at the geopolitics of the world and obviously making, you know, agendas and principles and precepts and purposes that are to cure these manifestations of, you know, our ignorance and also our greed and all kinds of other things. And none of it changes. None of it. So when I look at geopolitics, I look at it in the context that, like, look, all of these folks who are doing all of this stuff, supposedly, need to be scrapped. They need to be scrapped. And basically, it needs to be a situation that it is understood that there needs to be accomplishment, not constant negotiation, not constant dealing with the turmoil and the stress and the strife after it's happening, and, you know, furthering it by not being able to really articulate what should happen effectively and collectively group-wise. Just get rid of them. Start over with people basically who really will have a heart for doing this. And I don't really care about their education. That's cool, and I'll accept that, and I understand that. But I care more about their ability to see beyond the reputation that they have, the fundamentals, you know, obviously of who they are versus the fundamentals of the problems. So when I look at geopolitics, that's what I look at.
Okay. Okay, Michelle, you have anything?
No.
I know you do.
Well, but yeah, I mean, he's correct, Joe, you're correct, because if you look at history, our political history, and all of the problems in our country, they're the same problems that we've always had, just on another level, just getting worse. Nothing's ever being fixed. Nothing's ever being, you know, they don't have a plan for anything. You still have famine. You still have homelessness. You have so many things that's going on that there's nothing. It's like there's nothing in place to repair things or to fix it. There's no laws, no rules, or anything, you know, especially with them reversing stuff now. So I kind of agree with what you're saying. This geo stuff, the politics, politicians, everybody's doing basically the same thing as far as I'm concerned, and getting nothing done.
Amen. It is very true. And let me just categorically state for the record, as one, you know, who obviously would seek to be in a leadership position or role, as far as our people are concerned, the final, I guess you could say, edict of this entire situation of geo-global politics and also just the basic level of these things as we exist in the various parts of the world, be it countries, nations, whatever you want to, you know, term it,
right,
is the fact that it still remains the same. There is a core group of individuals collectively forming a group that orchestrates the welfare and non-well-being of the geopolitics throughout the world.
Right.
And they are very wealthy, they are very powerful, and they are very connected in that 1% percentage that control all of this. And in that, I would dissolve that completely. You know, see, I am of the mind that, you know, as someone seeking, you know, the ability to have some sort of leadership role and organization that really accomplishes things, I don't want these people with money. I don't want these people who are, you know, wealthy and you know, obviously do the things that they do, because to me, they are both, one, non-productive,
right,
unless it is in their interest. And two, they are basically, you know, completely sequestered in the strength of their world and those who exist in their world who are like them.
Right. They have
no knowledge, yeah, and understanding of the common man. They have no knowledge or understanding, you know, of anything other than people basically are just incidentals. And they are incidentals in the context of what they can do for us. So that's how these powerful people that control a lot of these circumstances and situations, you know, geopolitically or just here in the United States, they look at people as just being incidentals who are there to manifest whatever it is they want and whatever it is they need to continue to, you know, fund their coffers, their lifestyle, their way of doing things, and that's it. Above and beyond that, they don't really care because they don't have to basically face the aspect of poverty. They don't have to face the aspect of famine. They don't have to face the aspect of, you know, economic decline, you know, racism, none of that. See, money preempts all of those things and keeps that away from you. If anything, you contribute to those other things because of your, you know, wealth and your ability to rise above all of that, because you basically in many ways have a structure that permits it and it funds you. Whether it's good times or bad times, whether it's, you know, basically rich or poor, it doesn't affect you. Monetarily, you will always make money because that is the world you exist in. For me, as one who would be a black leader, even in the black leadership that we have now, I would literally basically, you know, tell them to just take a walk and pick up on Philly talk. Go find
Island. Yeah, do you think we have a black leadership in place now?
No, we don't. No, we don't.
We're recruiting because we need someone. All right.
We have a lot of black leaders who say that they are leaders, but they're all about the money. And ain't nothing else funny. I mean, you look at basically, you know, if you want to call LeBron James a leader, no. You want to call Herschel Walker a leader? Well, we don't know.
No, don't mention him, please.
Right. You want to call Kanye West a leader? No. But what do they all have in common?
Money.
Money.
Exactly. And you see, that's the problem. When leadership begins to articulate itself in the context of wealth, it immediately degradates its ability to be effective. Because you see, if you have money, at least 95% of your time has to be invested in keeping that money. And if you have that money and 95% of your time is invested in keeping that money, that means that basically 100% of your time has to be invested in keeping it and making more.
And also maintaining that status quo. Don't you think that it's in the rich, the 1%, as you say, it's in their best interest for the structure to remain the same, meaning the rich at the top and the poor at the bottom. Otherwise, you have to throw the whole thing out. If any of those pieces are missing.
They have no reason to exist as the rich if there are no poor.
Right.
That's the thing that makes basically the equation workable.
Right.
You know, if I'm up here and there is nobody down here, then there is no reason for my existence up here. And that's it.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Right.
Okay, good. Good.
I mean, the poor is who keeps the economy going.
Yeah.
There got to be somebody that's at the bottom, right, that holds everything up.
And they can't relate to it. So when you have rich people speaking for us, they really don't know the struggles that we have, the needs that we have, anything that, you know, has anything to do with poverty because they've never been there. They don't understand it. So how could you have people speaking for us if they don't know, they've never been in that position? How can you speak for me?
Well, there's another part to that, too. And this is something that I would look at and will always look at moving, you know, to obviously being a leadership position for our people. And let me just say one of the other facets that I did not mention, but it is very important and it fits directly into this, is the ability basically as a leader and a group, you know, obviously that is leading a charge in this direction to be able to properly, and please understand that word, properly educate our people, because we are not being properly educated.
That's for sure.
We are all over the place and we are not being given one specific understanding of truth and what have you. And your point about, you know, these people being rich and not understanding who we are. Well, take, for instance, LeBron. He comes from poverty. Take the aspect basically of Kanye. He comes from poverty. These were not rich people by any stretch of the imagination in the years growing up. And a lot of other folks You know, Tiger, basically. He wasn't rich, but he came from a middle class. So these people have an understanding, but you know what the problem is? They have divorced themselves from that understanding. They have forgotten these things because money does that to you. Your whole agenda and all involved in your existence change because you don't mess with people who are in poverty. You mess with people who are of like mind, like you, rich.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't want to change it anymore.
Right.
Yeah, Joe, let me change it around a little. I want to ask you this question here. All right, you know, in the world that we live in, well, the country that we live in, you know, we got basically a 50-50 split between the right and the left or the moderates or whatever. How would you, as a Black leader, leverage that? Is there a possibility? Because, you know, I was taught that, you know, out of chaos becomes opportunity. There's opportunity in chaos.
Well, there's opportunity in chaos if it is truly chaos. Let me say that again. There is opportunity in chaos if it is truly chaos.
All right. So you wouldn't equate the current condition as chaos, the environment?
No.
As chaos?
There is a difference in chaos that is truly chaos. The unpredictability, the situation of never seeing it coming. What we are seeing is controlled chaos, okay. Intentional chaos. Because the intent in this particular chaos that we're seeing is to continue to keep the masses confused, to keep them separated, to keep them always chasing something that really doesn't exist, but is being perpetuated for the purposes of maintaining control.
Right, right.
And that's what we're seeing. This is not chaos because it's chaos. This is chaos that is, and if you think about the history of leadership and you think about basically the situation of just the United States itself, much less the world, this is not something that we have not seen before. This is the history of this country. This chaos has always existed, but it is a methodology that has been put in place to be able to control the masses, to split this group from that group, to split this ideology from that ideology, to introduce this into the ideology versus this in their ideology. You know, it's all a controlled chaos. Because you see, true chaos, if you look up just the definition of chaos, true chaos is uncontrollable. True chaos is a volcano that's sitting in Hawaii that is the largest, you know, volcano in the world. And the true chaos of that is they have no idea when that bad boy is going to go off. Right. They just know that they see the rumblings of the possibility that it's coming, but they cannot predict it and they cannot stop it. That's true chaos. True chaos.
You're right. You are right. They can't control that.
This can be controlled. And that's what they do. They control it. And see, my feeling as a Black leader, because we are a people basically who has been orchestrated, manipulated, calculated in the realm of chaos. Our existence in these United States as a people has been in the throngs of chaos. But it is a well-planned chaos. It is not just an arbitrary chaos that has come out of nowhere. I mean, look, the universe has chaos. And it is uncontrolled chaos. No man can predict it. No man can stop it. Meteorites, supernovas, black holes, new galaxies being formed. That's chaos. A beautiful chaos, but a chaos just the same.
Right.
An uncontrollable phenomenon.
Right.
But we are not living with chaos that is controlled. We are living with chaos that is well orchestrated, well planned, and well applied. And I would get rid of all of these folks. I mean, and see, that's the problem. If you don't get rid, let me put it to you this way. As a leader, one must always understand in the scope of a society and the constituents that I, you know, as a leader would be responsible, you know, for and would be responsible to. I have to understand that basically that becomes an organism because that's what human society is. It's an organism. Right. And I have to understand the fact that, like any organism, if there is a poison in any part of that organism, a cancer, we know what cancer does. It does not just stay where it is. Once it has really, you know, right, poisoned and degraded the area it's in, it has to survive. And in order to survive, what does it do? It moves. It spreads, looking for solid, good tissue. These people that I'm talking about in Black leadership and obviously in leadership in general, that 1%, these are cancers. These are cancers that need to be cut away and need to be removed because they are too ingrained in the poison, basically, of a system that has done nothing but create intentional chaos and poisoning of its people. And I'm not even just talking Black folk. I'm talking white folk, too. They're just, okay, for whatever reasons, too dumb to figure it out. Or they just accept it. I'm not sure which one. But that, to me, is what a Black leader has to be about today. I need to be able to tell Al Sharpton to take a walk. You've made your money. Go get an island, sit there, and do whatever you're going to do. Because you're not really doing anything except making more money off of the misery, basically, of our people. I need to be able to tell a whole bunch of folks that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I look at the leadership, basically, of, like, you know, Obama. Yeah, okay, we get the first Black president, whatever. He's in a system that basically was not going to permit him to do anything. He did nothing for us as Black people, as a leader, because he couldn't.
He couldn't
do anything. He was hamstringed, you know, to begin with. I mean, he was just a figurehead. But the point of the matter is, there was a benefit to him being a president. And you know what that benefit is?
What is that?
The benefit was his. He made a ton of money, and he's continuing to make a ton of money. He left that office and gets billion-dollar deals with Netflix and all these other folks. The presidency was a catalyst for him. It did not change the situation, basically, in Chicago with massive killings. It did not change the situation with the incarceration rate of Black males. It did not change the circumstances of, you know, young, unwed Black mothers having all of these children who will grow up to basically feed the very system, you know, that obviously has always been there, you know, and that they've been intentionally created to feed. No education in their neighborhoods, no proper schools in their neighborhoods.
But doesn't that show you that the president having a title does not really mean anything? They're still controlled by a group of rich people. You still have no power.
Are you asking me that question, or?
Yeah. I mean, doesn't that show that there's nothing, that everything is ran by rich people?
Oh, most certainly. Most certainly. And here he is. He's a rich guy. So what is he going to do now? Because you see, the other part of it that obviously as a leader must be understood is when you walk into the corridors of this power, you immediately basically become powerless. And the more you have to take from that corridor of power, the more powerless you will become. Because see, your whole position of power is predicated upon them, not upon you, not upon your people, you. And you cannot afford to step on any toes because everything you get comes from that power. Everything you get. So you have to shut up and just basically do your due. And that's what Obama has done. He's not basically, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say that they're not doing some things here and there. But in the overall scope of things, these folks have not spoke out the way I would envision, basically, like a Malcolm X did, like a Martin Luther King did. They have not even basically the people who are associated with those folks spoke out. H. Rapp Brown, Stokely Carmichael. You know, I mean, the list goes on because I grew up with these people. These were my mentors.
They weren't just mouth. They were action. They spoke of
very
action.
Much. Angela Davis. I saw an interview with Angela Davis the other day.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Black leader, and I was quite shocked in what I heard her say.
What's that?
Well, she talked about basically LGBT, you know, communities and this and that. Equating all of that with the struggle of Black
people. Oh my goodness. That's horrible.
And I was like, but that's what happens. You live long enough in this system, it will do one of two things to you. As a black leader, it will either kill you because it realizes you are not to be controlled, or it will water you down.
You're a threat. Yeah, they'll kill you because you're a threat to the nation.
Right.
To change.
Or it will water you down and you will eventually become just like those just that like obviously them. You fought against.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I got a question for you. You know that, you know, becoming a black leader based on our history, it's a dangerous job, right?
Right.
Are you prepared to give your life in pursuit of being a black leader, becoming a black leader?
Anyone who sees the truth in a matter and who moves to be able to, you know, bring that truth to light must understand that the powers that be who depend upon your stupidity will obviously become a threat to you because you become a threat to them. The greatest person on the planet is the person who obviously knows the truth and who is not afraid to impart that truth and must understand in that capacity that your enemies will be insurmountable and that your enemies will even be your own people. And that they, as well as basically those you fight against, stand in a position that if you interfere with their good thing, they will try to remove you in some way, shape, form, or fashion. So as a black leader looking at this, I have two choices. And those two choices basically are what every leader has, black or not. But let's say in this particular instance, because we're dealing with black folk and our history, and the future of us, you have two choices. And that choice is to know that basically either you are going to tell the truth and speak the truth and know that your enemy is not going to like that, and probably a vast majority of your own people are not going to like that, and you are going to be on the chopping block always. Or you can speak the truth in a way that is not the truth and be rewarded for that by your enemies and by your own people. Because you are, you know, obviously in a situation where they don't have to fear for what they want to keep and what they want to get. And the same applies for your enemy. He does not have to fear you because he knows basically, you know, you can be brought. So yeah, I definitely think about that. But the end result is, you know, I mean, don't you think about that every single day with your family and raising your family and taking care of your family?
Yeah.
You think about basically the course of action that you have to take. Not always good, not always basically, you know, what you would want. But the fact is you have to at some point have a moral compass in what you're going to do for your family, because you obviously don't want to threaten the well-being of your family. And you as a father, you as a mother, you are going to do what has to be done, and you are going to say to yourself, no matter what the risk is, the thing that I must be very aware of is the sanctity, the security, and the well-being, and the well-being of, you know, obviously my family. And you will go out on whatever limb you have to ensure that. Well, as a black leader, my people are my family, then I am almost obligated and duty bound to do the same thing for them that I would do for my own family. But you see, black leaders don't look at it like that.
No, they don't.
They don't see that. They look at it as like, yeah, I'm going to do what's in the best interest of my family, and I'm going to get paid very well, and I'm going to give, you know, some lip service over here for all those folks that obviously I'm supposed to be, you know, orchestrating whatever I'm supposed to be orchestrating for, and so on. I look at the situation of a man who has become a leader in the black community, Benjamin Crump.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I don't know how.
Yeah. And it's a very interesting dichotomy that takes place with his leadership, because he is not necessarily a leader in the context of like a Malcolm or you know, a Martin Luther King or, you know, Huey Newton, and so on and so forth. He is leading completely from the aspect of money, completely. Because every case he takes, millions are being paid out. Now, I look at this and I say, well, it's good in one sense, but what does it do in the other sense? You know, because he is making a fortune as just a casualty lawyer and what have you. And he's getting these black folks tremendous sums of money. But what is that doing basically beyond that?
Right. You know, where justice is being served.
I mean, you know, listen, his greatest hope, I think, sitting down at night is, you know, Lord, can we come up with basically like 5 more shootings this week?
Yeah, he's right. Ambulance chaser.
Right. That's 5 more cases.
Right. Counting on that.
Mm-hmm. But he is not saying anything that changes the dichotomy of that.
Right.
Because the end result is he won a magnanimous decision basically on the basis of Floyd. And he also won the case in court, or should I say the case in court was won in conjunction with his efforts to send those cops, you know, basically to prison. But did it stop anything?
Exactly. No, it did not stop anything.
No,
no.
Especially with the black on black crime. And that's the problem.
Right.
Right. You could basically win all the cases in the world. But if you don't do something to stop the situation, then you're just sitting back waiting for the next case. I mean, look at the young man sitting there in his car, and you see him on TV eating a hamburger.
Right.
Cat doesn't have a weapon in his hand. He has got a hamburger, a fully loaded hamburger. Pickles, mustard, ketchup, you know, lettuce, tomatoes, fully loaded. That's the only weapon he has in his hand, a fully loaded hamburger. Mm-hmm. And the cop unloads on him.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it stops? No, it's not going to stop.
No, continue.
Right. And, you know, it would have been better for Crump to invoke something basically legally that says taxpayers need to stop having to foot the bill for these, you know, criminal, psychotic, you know, reprobates that call themselves police. The police department should start having to pay, and the cop that did it should be paying. His life should be devastated monetarily. Because you know what? You start to affect their pocket, where it is not the city and your tax dollars and mine that have to pay these judgments, but it is the police department's situation that has to pay it.
Right.
And basically, right, it is the cop. And I guarantee you, people will back up real quick.
Yeah, they should have okay. something where, you know, make them pay for it out of their police funding.
Exactly, but see, that's not
happening. The taxpayers pay it, right.
Right, they're protected.
Now, they don't see that it's costing us the money and not them, and that's why they continue to.
Right, because, you know, they know that they're not going to have to pay. And see, that's what Crump should really be after. I mean, yes, he should be protecting these people, winning their rights, and in court doing what he's doing. But somebody should be moving to reverse this process. You want to stop these cops from killing? Let them have to realize that basically, you know, they obviously are in a situation where individually they can be sued, their house can be taken, and their family name can become your name because obviously you own them.
Hit them in the pocket, right.
Like they owned us in slavery. Now, you know, obviously, basically, you know, this was Floyd. You know, now obviously that cop's family's name is now Floyd. It's no longer, you know, whatever it was, you know, Lowry or whatever. He's now Floyd. The entire family's Floyd.
Right, right.
And they've lost their house and everything.
Yeah.
That changes people's basically attitudes. And as a black leader, that would be a very significant thing that I would want to do. I would involve basically the courts and everyone in the fight to change that. Taxpayer dollars should not be used to fund murder and murderers.
I like that. I like that. And this leads me to your approach. Now, when I say approach, I'm talking about early Malcolm X versus Martin Luther King. And you know that Malcolm X wanted to do things not peacefully, all right, for lack of a better term. Okay, which approach would you use? Would you use more of a we shall overcome peaceful type approach? Or do you think we should do something else?
That is a very difficult question because obviously, you know, it brings into contention the fact that in all things that we do as human beings, we must always think very clearly about the aspect of the fact that chaos is in play always. So do you now basically add to that chaos? Do you become part of that chaos? Or do you find a way to actually control that chaos? So that's the first thing that I look at in your question. If I look at Malcolm's way, it can be basically something that becomes chaotic and can turn on you. Because you are dealing with a system that is completely powerful enough to eradicate you if it chooses to do so. And to do it basically with little to no humanity or compassion. We know this because that's exactly what basically has happened to us for over 400 years of slavery and obviously continued mental slavery. We have seen the ruthlessness of our enemy, and they are ruthless and they have the power to be ruthless. So Malcolm's way, understandably, was a way. But given the circumstances of who you'd have to go up against to carry that edict out, they would wipe you out. And they would do so with great, basically, you know, authority and with great, you know, planning.
Enthusiasm.
Yeah. So we know that that has its problems. I mean, look, the real reason we know that that has its problems has nothing to do with us beyond a certain point. But when you look at what they do to their own, they will kill their own. They will imprison their own. Look at those cats, you know, I forgot what part of the country it was, Montana, somewhere out there. And that family, I can't even remember the family's name. But these white dudes, you know, who were obviously saying the federal government was impeding upon their land and their rights and the this and the that. There was a father who was the main, you know, head of this family. And, you know, they were saying that they're giving too much of the territory to the Native Americans. They weren't going to have it. So they had a standoff. They, you know, had all these cats coming in, white boys with all these guns.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can't
remember. Like I said, I forgot the family name. And, you know, I thought to myself, look at this. Now, if we as a people, black people did that, they would have swooped in so fast, we wouldn't have had time to even think about what hit
just
us.
Just like the insurrection.
White boys carried this on for months.
That's right.
They carried this on. Until finally, one of them basically took over a federal building of some sort over there, you know, out in the plains or somewhere. It was a federal, you know, building. And, you know, he was the son of this father.
Wow.
He took that over and held it, you know, hostage and so on. And they wound up killing him and killing a bunch of the others. And I think also imprisoning the father. So we have to understand that, you know, they will not even permit their own to rise up against them. They will put them down very quick. Look at January the 6th. All these cats going to jail. You know what I mean? They will put down an uprising of their own just as quickly. And they will be brutal about it if that's what they're forced to do. So what does that say they would do to us? We know
genocide. Genocide. I mean, you know, you got a significant number of them that want to do that.
Right. And we would give them the excuse to do it.
Right.
So my thought process is, no, we don't want to go there. It is not to say that there may come a time that we might have to go there, but we better really, really be in a position to do that if that's what we're going to do. The circumstance in being a black leader today is being able to obviously understand the nature of the positions that exist in this quagmire of intentional chaos and being able to spread the truth. And that is even hard because we now have, as a result of, you know, this reprobate Trump, the ability to say what's fake, what's false, and so on. You could take the truth and everybody can turn it basically whatever way they want and say that it's false. So we have to be about the business of educating our people. My thought process on this is, as a black leader, I have to spend an exorbitant amount of time trying to re-educate our people to understand the nature of those who obviously we have seen do very well and how they have done very well and why they have done very well. And we need to understand what our position is in all of this and how to accomplish the same thing.
Okay.
And it cannot be done basically in any other way than a reorientation of our thinking. I mean, look, we have to understand, you know, apartheid was legal. The Holocaust was legal. Slavery was legal. Colonialism was legal. The legality is a matter of power, not justice. And it has always been that. It is a matter of who is in power and obviously their ability to dictate the justice. Carter G. Woodson said this: if the Negro in the ghetto must eternally be fed by the hand that pushes him into the ghetto, he will never become strong enough to get out of the ghetto.
Well, Farrakhan. Very true.
Farrakhan said this: now you can dislike white folk. That's entirely up to you. But Elijah Muhammad was saying, get past that and observe the operations of a man that has captured the world and made the world bow down to his way of civilization. Think about that. Think about that. And there's one last that I'm going to give you, because this is very important as well. And this came from Lyndon Baines Johnson, the president of the United States that came after Kennedy as a result of Kennedy's assassination. This is what Lyndon Baines Johnson said. Please hear this. I'll tell you what's at the bottom of it, he says. If you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on, and he'll even empty his pocket for you.
Incredible.
Yes, yes. I've heard that from a different way, from a different person, but...
Lyndon Baines is the captain that wrote it. He's this is his quote. He said it. I remember simply because when I was obviously a kid and Kennedy was assassinated and so on, I remember him saying it. I mean, literally, I remember him saying it on television. I wish I'd been trying to find the recording and whatnot, but this is the truth of it. So the first thing that has to happen as far as being a leader is that there needs to be a serious attempt to re-educate our people, to re-educate them on the fact that basically we have nothing, even though many of us may have something, and we will not have the power and the authority to change our circumstances until we become one collective mindset. You can believe something here and you can believe something there, but when it comes to the nature of your existence as a people, that mindset must be the overwhelming mindset that all espouse to. And I give you the prime example of whites. They don't necessarily agree with each other, but one thing for sure, they agree with the fact that basically they need to maintain a consistent level of control.
I was going to say this.
Yeah, well, you look at the Jews also. The Jews, that's a good example.
I was going to say the Jews as well.
Yeah.
They may not like each other, but when it comes to the power of basically the Jewish community, the authority of the Jewish community, and the maintenance of the Jewish philosophy and presence, they are of one mind.
That's right. That's right.
And they do not change that. You know what I'm saying? They will not change that no matter what. Like I said, I don't have to like you, but we are Jews.
That's it.
And that becomes the overwhelming precedent for our existence. Our people, we know not that feeling. We know not that understanding. We know not that presence and power and what it is and what it does. It dictates your ability to overcome anything and anyone, because you have the power to do so. You have the collectiveness to do so. That is the thing that I believe is first and foremost as a black leader in terms of our people. I don't want to talk to white folks. I don't want to talk to white folks about it. I don't need to talk to them. I need to talk to our people and to begin to get them to understand the mindset that will bring us as a people to a position, obviously, of controlling and understanding our own authority and ability to really be a people that has a power, not to be used wrongly, but to be able to maintain the consistent level of our existence. Right now, and I don't remember, I can't remember, and I have to look it up, But there's a spot in Jersey, not too far outside of Philadelphia, of Montgomery County, New Hope, in that area. Now, Lambertville, I think, or it's something like that it's called. But I could be wrong. It may have another name. But the thing that I find fascinating about this area, it is a Jewish enclave. I mean, literally, the entire town is Jewish. But what they've done is interesting. They basically take the properties to ensure that no one else can move in other than Jews. They take a property that basically is worth maybe $200,000, mm-hmm. and they elevate the price to $600,000+. So obviously that rules everybody out because nobody can afford that. And then a Jewish family will move in. They will not pay that $600,000. They will only pay the $200,000. And the Jews have devised a system of being able to take what they estimated it at as that $600,000 and devalue it to such a degree in such a way that it's never even seen as that. But yet, governmentally and tax-wise, they get the advantages of that price. Ensuring that the community remains Jewish, ensuring that basically they control the community, and so on. It's amazing. And I've got a whole thing on it. You know what I'm saying? Because I was studying it, and I was just floored by what I saw. Even to the point of having basically their hands in the welfare system. Because they are able to negotiate the position they put it in that they can actually get welfare.
They can, because they don't use their last names. Yeah, right. They do. Yeah. They don't use it. They're sitting there in the welfare office with them. And then when they do the statistics, they're only doing it in the ghetto areas of Black communities, not the Jewish communities, because they are the bulk of the people that are on the system.
But they Michelle, it's amazing. It is amazing. But again, that's not, you know, because that's criminal to me. I mean, they should be really being held accountable.
Yeah, it's fraudulent.
That's right.
Because they're stealing. They're stealing, and they're obviously also being racist. They're literally basically presenting a racist situation that says only Jews can live here.
Right.
But we can't say that, and we can't actually advertise that, and we can't do it. But we can obviously, you know, since we own this entire, you know, area, we can literally do what we want on paper to monetarily make it look like what we want it to look like, and no one can afford it, but then we slide Jewish families in. So, you know, again, I have to go back. We need to be educated. We need to be educated because everything we're seeing is a distortion of the facts as it would pertain to our people. We're seeing, like I said, you know, we're seeing the Puff Daddies and the LeBron Jameses and, you know, the Kanye Wests and the Kardashians. We're seeing all this really goofy stuff. I mean, you know, and I'm not saying LeBron is goofy. Please don't get me wrong. But, you know, he is not in any way indicative of the mind thrust of a commonality in our people. And that is what's missing. He's LeBron. That's it.
Yeah.
He's LeBron. He's a, you know, superstar on the court. He's a superstar in business. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Superstar in entertainment. But that is not a mindset that is conducive to the collective. That's a mindset that's conducive to him.
Individual.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Right.
Well, anyway, before I don't want to cut you off, Mr. Williams, but Michelle, do you have any other questions for Mr. Williams?
No, I do not. Thank you so much. This was a great interview. You did amazing.
All right. Yeah. Yes, yes. Mr. Williams, we'd like to thank you for coming in. Just want to go over a couple of things here. You know, this is a full-time 724 position, right? Mm-hmm. And your compensation, that'll come, but it's history. You'll go down in history. And I think you'll have a legacy if you should take this position. But we do have a couple more candidates that we do want to interview. Is that, you know, we have to follow the rules and exercise the process. So we will be getting back to you. And again, we want to thank you for coming in for this interview. You have any questions for us?
No, hey, listen, I truly appreciate the time, folks. And obviously, again, I hope that I was able to give you, you know, a semblance and understanding of what I, as a Black leader, you know, seeking this position would, you know, be about and would try to do. And I just hope that obviously you're successful in being able to find whomever, whether it's me or not, is really not relevant. What is relevant is the person basically who you do find and their ability to carry out the edict that needs to be carried out. Doesn't have to be me, as long as it's somebody basically who knows the truth and is willing to give you the truth in terms of what has to be done. And I truly appreciate your time. I truly appreciate your efforts. And I will always, always be available and in your corner should you need it.
We appreciate that. We appreciate that so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.